That lines Israel's latest raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque prompts a flurry of reactions from governments, people, and organizations around the globe. Iran says the UK government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is a shirking of responsibility and violates the commitments of the UN Refugee Convention. Also, Pope Francis calls for an impartial approach towards refugees, irrespective of their color, and says dividing refugees into Ukrainian and non-Ukrainian is racist. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to protest Israeli crackdown in the occupied Al-Quds. The rally comes amid a surge in Israeli violations against the holy city. The Palestinian Red Crescent says more than 340 Palestinians have been injured in Israeli attacks. Ashraf Shannon has more.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear full responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vow to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Iran's foreign minister has strongly condemned the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Israeli regime. He says the developments unfolding in the Muslim's third holiest site show that the Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving, and Israel is in a state of desperation. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments during a phone call with Ismail Haniyeh, the head of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement. Amir Abdullahian said the resistance is now at its peak, while the Israeli regime has never been weaker. He said Iran supports the establishment of an integrated Palestinian state across the historical territories with Al-Quds as its capital. The top Iranian diplomat said the raid on Palestinian worshippers is one of the adverse consequences of a handful of Arab countries normalizing ties with the regime. For his part, Haniyeh said the Palestinians have two options before them: submission to the Judaization of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or resistance against Israel. They have chosen the latter. International reactions keep pouring in over Israel's violation, including its deadly crackdown against Palestinians in occupied Al-Quds. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Palestinians have described the aggression as equal to declaration of war. They have called for international intervention to prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Turkey, Iraq, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia have strongly condemned Israeli raids, saying Tel Aviv must be held to account. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement denounced the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque too, and hailed Palestinian steadfastness against Israel. Jordanians also hit the streets of the capital Amman in solidarity with the Palestinians. Protesters gathered near the Israeli embassy waving Palestinian flags. Meanwhile, the UN chief has voiced grave concern over the situation in Al-Quds and urged Israeli and Palestinian leaders to prevent further escalation. The European Union has called for an immediate end to violence in Al-Quds. Germany, France, Italy, and Spain have also issued a joint statement expressing concern, but falling short of condemning Israel's assaults. Russia, however, has slammed Israeli actions and criticized the regime for turning the Gaza Strip into, quote, a prison under open sky. Moscow has also blasted what it calls the illegal occupation and creeping annexation of the Palestinian territories, and Israel's main backer, the U.S., says it is deeply concerned about the latest escalation, urging all sides to exercise restraint. Pro-Palestine activist Charlotte Cates says that the Israeli attack on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a horrific act against Palestinian people as a whole.
It's absolutely a horrific attack on the Palestinian people and on Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and on the Palestinian people as a whole. This is a site that is sacred, that is respected by all Palestinians. And so it's a very deliberate attempt by a colonial state, by a colonial power, to attack people who are engaged in worship, who are engaged in prayer, and who are saying that Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be destroyed, will not be undermined. You know, there has been an attempt by the same regime to stir up the most racist, extreme Zionist settlers to engage in, you know, the slaughtering of sacrifices at Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to essentially create a desecration, in order to create a false view of what's happening in Palestine as if this is a struggle between religions rather than what it is, a fight for people against colonialism, against a Zionist regime, a project that is supported by U.S. imperialism, by the European Union, by Canada, by the United Kingdom, in order to undermine and seize and control Palestinian land and resources. And this includes the attack on holy sites that are very sacred to Muslims, to Christians, and to the Palestinian people as a whole.
Israel's Friday attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Quds has sparked a wave of angry reactions on social media. People have slammed the international community's inaction to stop Israel's crimes against Palestinians. Hashtag Trending brings you more of these reactions.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. So tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territory since the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. And Friday saw an escalation in one of the holiest sites for Muslims all around the world. Just at dawn on Friday, Israeli forces raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and fired rubber bullets and sound bombs at the worshippers there. And as a result of the Israeli aggression, some 150 Palestinians were wounded and hundreds were arrested. Come on, 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 come on The Israeli act of aggression sparked a wave of outrage on social media, with many users pointing out the fact that this is not even the first time that the Israelis attacked the holy site during the month of Ramadan. They also said that Muslims around the world must unite and stand against Israeli apartheid. The first tweet of the day comes from Code Pink. They said, "Every year during Ramadan, the Israeli occupation forces attack Al-Aqsa, one of the holiest sites in Islam. Palestinians defend themselves, Zionists use it to justify Israel's violence. This is the violence U.S. taxpayers fund. Do not look away." Nuha has our next tweet. "Israel has been attacking and killing Palestinians again during the holy month of Ramadan and again attacking the most holy mosque, Al-Aqsa. This apartheid has been for 74 years and is still ongoing. They especially attack during this holy time at places of worship, pure evil." Our next tweet comes from Turgay Evren. He said, "No difference this year. The fate of Masjid al-Aqsa is the same this Ramadan as well. While we Muslims are busy fighting each other, Israel keeps attacking the worshippers in the first Qibla of Islam. What will bring us to our senses? I don't know." Numerous comments were also posted on social media blaming the West and mainstream media for keeping silent regarding the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. People say that if such an event were to occur at a church or at a temple, it would make headlines everywhere on every major news outlet. Moving on to our next batch of comments, Abiha Zahra said, "I am sorry this is not Ukraine, so the world will remain silent. This is Palestine, where people get tortured by Israelis every day. Where is humanity? Where are human rights champions?" Let's have a look. Humanity in Danger has our next tweet. They said, "The Israeli forces attack worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque, injuring 158, arresting more than 400 Palestinians. Imagine if the same thing was done by Muslims in any church or temple. It would be in headlines on every news channel, but who cares, because victims are Muslims, not Europeans." That is the very definition of double standards for you right there. Ismail Patel has our next tweet. "If this was happening to other people's place of worship by an occupying force, it would be all over the news. Are Muslim values worthless? This is more than about Palestinians." That is definitely the case. Some say that the Israeli attack on defenseless Palestinian worshippers and the desecration of their holy site, during their holy month, mind you, amounts to an act of terrorism, and the international media has a responsibility to properly cover it and to condemn the attack as such as an act of terror. Moving on to our final batch of comments, Farida Fadil said, "Attacking civilians during their prayers and rituals and defiling their holy places is an act of terror, and whoever does it is a terrorist." Dr. Salman Butt has our next tweet. 50,000 attended Friday prayers in defiance of the annual trend of settlers of the last remaining European colony in the Middle East violently attacking defenseless worshippers in the holy month of Ramadan. Final comments comes from Rebelet. She says, "Israeli terrorists attacking Palestinians in Al-Aqsa Mosque, the holiest site in Palestine for Islamic prayer. No media coverage nor no international media has condemned this attack. If other holy sites were desecrated and invaded like this, we would be seeing world coverage." And that brings us to the end of this edition of Hashtag Trending. Many thanks. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Tehran has decried Britain's announced plan to force asylum seekers residing in the country into migrating to Rwanda. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said the move means the UK is shirking its international responsibilities and obligations and passing the buck to a third country. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the move is also in violation of asylum seekers' rights stipulated in relevant conventions and human rights treaties. Britain announced its plan on Thursday to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda for processing and settlement there. The British government says it aims to tackle people smuggling and fix its broken asylum system, but opposition politicians and human rights defenders have branded it as inhumane. The UN also said the plan raises human rights concerns. Earlier, our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, joined us in the news review with her take on the reasons behind the UK's plan to transfer asylum seekers to Rwanda.
Initially, single males who have crossed into the UK via the channel, the English channel between France and England, they will be the first with flights expected to go in a matter of weeks. Now, here is the rub. Because this isn't something that you can quantify in terms of benefits for the United Kingdom, it's being put out there as a complete deterrent. Because if we cast our minds back just a few weeks ago, when Britain launched a scheme to welcome in Ukrainian refugees, which the House of Ukrainian Refugee Program, where inducements and financial incentives were given to Brits who wanted to take one or two members of those from Ukraine fleeing the conflict there, you will see very clearly that Britain doesn't have a resource problem, it might have a racism problem. And let's be honest, how many of those who are on the streets here in London, in Birmingham, in Manchester, can point to where Rwanda is on the map? But it's the same old, where Britain tries to outsource its problem, outsource its issues, and usually it's the third world, the emerging and the global south that has to end up bearing the burden on this. The idea is ridiculous.
We are racist, and that is bad. That is what the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis, has said when commenting on the different treatment of Ukrainian refugees and those from elsewhere. The Pope was speaking with the Italian television. He said people fleeing are divided into first class and second class, and by their skin color. He added that they are also divided on whether they come from a developed or non-developed country. In the recent weeks, Europe has come under the spotlight over its response to millions of refugees from Ukraine who have fled the ongoing war in their country. European governments are criticized for being more welcoming to the Ukrainians than to refugees from the Middle East or Africa. There has also been anger over alleged discrimination against African residents of Ukraine at the borders. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. There is a well-known sentence in the Commander of Faithful's letter to Malik al-Ashtar. Imam Ali Salam tells him to employ people with such and such characteristics. He mentions certain qualities and says that Malik must choose, as his colleagues, people with those qualities. After mentioning those qualities, he says, "You should have a piercing eye in this matter, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons." This is astonishing. The Commander of the Faithful says this to Malik al-Ashtar 20 plus years after the Holy Prophet's demise. This is a reference to the domination of Bani Umayyad and the like. They were people who would pronounce morning prayers with 4-6 rak'ats instead of 2. And after that, they would say, "We were well, we feel great. If you wish, we can even say longer prayers for you." They are the manifestation of this, because this religion has formerly been a prisoner in the hands of vicious persons.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When action was taken according to passion and worldly wealth was sought, such individuals use religion as a tool for achieving wealth and realizing their selfish desires. We, whether ourselves or our people, seek shelter in God, the Exalted, and ask Him to protect us from these hard snares set by the Satan. I hope that we ourselves will listen to this advice first, and that it will influence others as well. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, make this month a blessed month for the entire Islamic Ummah and for the dear Iranian nation. Dear God, make the holy heart of the Imam of the Age satisfied and pleased with us. Help us benefit from the prayers and the satisfaction of the great personality, and send our greetings and regards to him as well. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The ongoing crisis in Ukraine has revealed the ugly face of Europe. It showed blatant racism against African, Arab, and Indian immigrants, despite all the human rights slogans adopted by European countries. Now, here is one shocking clip of African students who were denied the right to escape crisis-ridden Ukraine. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on racial discrimination of Africans fleeing Ukraine. The world was shocked but not surprised by high levels of flagrant racism perpetrated against the people of color in Europe. In the second part of our program, still on the issue of racism by Western imperialist powers, we are talking about the horrific transatlantic slave trade and asking, has slavery ended or does it still continue to devastate the people of Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Ukraine crisis exposes Europe's racism. The world has witnessed dehumanizing treatment against international students from Africa, South Asia, and the West Asia in Ukraine. Many Africans fleeing Ukraine and other wars and conflicts around the world have not received the same treatment as Ukrainian refugees. While white women and children were given priority on vehicles departing the country, African women were barred from trains leaving Kiev, even though there were empty seats.
A Nigerian student fleeing Ukraine gives an account of some of the incidents of racial discrimination they endured. Let's take a listen.
I started running from 25th of last month. Crossing the foreign border to Poland was devastating because of the discrimination. The first discrimination was at Kyiv train station. They were allowing, they said, only women and children. I said, okay, that's fine. But I don't see you taking the other African women and the other Middle Eastern women that are pregnant. And they were actually in the cold, some with their kids.
Now, for more on the horrific scenes of racial discrimination against Africans in Ukraine and other parts of Europe, we contacted Nefla Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Now, our first question to you, to what extent has the crisis in Ukraine exposed the evil of racism, which Europe has been trying for a long time to disguise?
I think it exposed the racial discrimination a lot for those of us who understand the geopolitical context and that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is the primary contradiction in this issue. Everything leading up to that is because of that, and the NATO being a military alliance of the Western European nations and their contradictory or double standard way of dealing with other countries in the world.
African students in Ukraine did not just face racial discrimination, but there were also disturbing reports of many being forced to join the country's military forces. Ukraine's president has been appealing to people of goodwill worldwide to support his country amid the blatant acts of racial discrimination against non-white immigrants, particularly blacks and Arabs in his country.
It's a proxy state. The government is. And proxy states expect returns for their service of being a proxy. So when he makes these appeals, he's also expecting the backing and the support of, which we've seen with United States and other Western nations also inducing their populations and inducing as much as they can around the world to respond to these appeals.
The Ukrainian crisis has revealed deep-rooted racism in Western media's coverage of the conflict. Now, Western media outlets are under fire for the evidently racist undertones in their coverage of the unfolding humanitarian crisis. Now, these mainstream Western media outlets have amplified empathy for Europeans while normalizing the suffering of war and disaster in other regions of the world, such as Africa, West Asia, and Afghanistan.
Now the unthinkable has happened to them. And this is not a developing third world nation. This is Europe.
These are not refugees from Syria. These are refugees from neighboring Ukraine. I mean, that, quite frankly, is part of it. These are...
What does this level of bias and outright racism say about mainstream Western media outlets?
Western media are basically cheerleaders for imperialism. They portray conflicts in various places based on a reflection of what it means and for the interest of imperialism. Most of the conflicts in the world, most of them by and large, are instigated and supported and carried out by imperialism, even if it's through proxies or whatever. But they're for the ability, the imperialism requires the destabilization of various places so that the people in large, in mass, can't exercise self-determination and what happens with the resources of their country, the mineral resources, what happens with labor rights, all those type of things. And so when the media is reporting on places like, for example, what's happening with Ukraine, right, they're usually not reporting on a war or an atrocity that involves the opposition or the competition, so to speak, with the enemies of imperialism. They're usually reporting on imperialist wars and imperialist instigated wars, no matter how imperialism wants to characterize them. And so they report them the way imperialism wants them characterized. Here, it's in the interest of imperialism to report the most, you know, a one-sided and diabolical, you know, intent in terms of this war, because this is their adversary.
African countries condemned the mistreatment of African nationals trying to flee Ukraine during a special session of the United Nations General Assembly early March. Speaking during the session, Matho Joini, South Africa's ambassador to the UN, said her country joins other African countries in condemning the discrimination of Africans in Europe.
South Africa endorses the statement issued by the African Union Commission, expressing concern that the treatment given to African nationals and people of African descent at the borders of Ukraine, some of whom are not allowed to cross and move to safety. We urge European countries to take steps to resolve this situation, as all people have a right to cross international borders during times of conflict.
Have African countries reacted strongly enough to the acts of racism being perpetrated against their citizens in Ukraine and neighboring European countries?
I tend to think we want to make a distinction with the question, that we want to make a distinction when we say African countries between the leadership of the countries, and particularly we're talking about largely neocolonial states that are just having to be subservient to international finance capital, have all the trappings of independence, but they really are governed and manipulated by outside. And then there's the masses of the people on the ground who have a different reaction and who really, you know, are expressing whatever they can. So we have to make that distinction. On the ground, we have people who demonstrated about, you know, against these types of things and demonstrating in a lot of ways in for different aspects against this war that's taking place.
African students formally appear to be welcome into Ukraine and injected millions of dollars into the country's economy, but have now realized that they were truly not perceived as equal, but inferior by whites in this country. Now, Mr. Freeman, what lessons can Africans learn from this form of racism?
I think the lesson in it is that white supremacy is a global phenomenon, and it is also about power. And that we have to fight for power in this world, the power dispositions regarding the economic dispositions and political dispositions, how much we can control our own, we have self-determination. That's what we have to fight for, and we have to do it in a mass. And we have to realize that we're in a global struggle against white supremacy and international finance capital, against the rest of collective humanity.
The International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is observed annually on 21st of March. Despite such a day being marked globally, we are still witness to shocking incidents of racial discrimination.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Freeman. Is the so-called international community paying lip service to the struggle against racism?
I think it's very interesting in the sense that even as the question is posed, there's a sort of an underlining acknowledgement that when we say international community, we're really talking about the Western countries, Western leadership, you know, Western European countries, rather. And so the international community has to come to be redefined. It's going to be only paying lip service to these things, because the Western world's preeminence and its supremacy in the world is dependent on racial discrimination and those type of things. So it can only pay lip service to it. And so we have to come to redefine what international community means in a way so that it doesn't refer to the Western European elite, and that it becomes redefined through a people-centered process and struggle for self-determination and for socialism. And so we have to have that.
Now, that's an interesting perspective indeed. We need to redefine what really comprises of the international community. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, for your incisive analysis. And I'll take a short break. When we come back, we shall be talking about the transatlantic slave trade. Stay with us.
Remembering slavery.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
For over 400 years, nearly 20 million men, women, and children from Africa were the victims of the tragic transatlantic slave trade, one of the darkest chapters in human history. Now, this criminal trade was officially carried out by European colonial powers. In commemoration of the memory of the victims, the General Assembly of the United Nations on the 17th December 2007 declared the 25th of March as the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade, to be observed annually.
The resolution also called for the establishment of a program to mobilize educational institutions, civil society, and other organizations to inculcate in future generations the causes, consequences, and lessons of the transatlantic slave trade, and to communicate the dangers of racism and prejudice. This year, the President of the United Nations General Assembly, Abdullah Shahid, visited the Ark of Return, the United Nations permanent memorial to honor the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade.
Now, during his visit to this memorial site, which also stands testimony as a reminder that racism has no place in the world, he recalled his visit to Senegal's Gori Island.
Years ago, I visited Gori Island in Senegal, which was the largest slave trading center on the African coast from the 15th to the 19th century. I saw the small spaces, imagining the crowded rooms where the enslaved persons were packed. I will never forget the feeling of sorrow and distress, thinking on those who went through the very small door overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, for more on the remembrance of the inhuman transatlantic slave trade perpetrated by Western colonial powers, we contacted P.L.O. Lumumba, a renowned Pan-Africanist and academic. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, our first question, do you think the transatlantic slave trade is given the attention it deserves in Africa and the Americas?
I don't think so. I think whatever attention we give it is merely salutary. One would have expected that an event as devastating as it was is given attention which is continental. One would have expected that there is a day that is dedicated in all African countries to remember that unfortunate trade. But that does not happen. In fact, one can say that the commemoration is left to a few public-spirited individuals, and it barely gets mentioned in many African countries, which is tragic in itself.
The British royal couple visited Jamaica from March 22 to 24 this year in order to commemorate Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee. This was just before the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. The visit was met by protests from Jamaicans demanding an apology and reparations from Britain over its leading role in slave trade.
Because it is an insult to us, for these young people to be here to try to persuade us to keep the status quo in place when our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Now, Mr. Lumumba, what's your take on this visit, especially considering that Britain's royal family was deeply involved in colonialism and the slave trade?
Remember that the British monarch, particularly the current monarch, was present when colonialism was alive and well. And it saddens me that she is given the accolades which she does not deserve by those whose parents and those whose ancestors were traumatized and victimized by slavery. It is a case of selective amnesia on both sides. The monarch pretends that there was no slavery. The monarch pretends that there was no colonization, and the people also behave as if there was no slavery and no colonization. I think we should speak unanimously and tell the monarch that until there is an unequivocal apology from the British government, they will never be given the accolade that they so much crave for.
While slave trade helped turn America and Western European countries into economic giants they are today, many like these Jamaicans here protesting a visit by members of Britain's royal family are demanding an apology and reparations.
Respect us, man. Apologize now.
Sending a shout out to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and the entire royal family that reparation time come now.
Isn't it about time that European countries involved in the evil slave trade apologize and pay reparations to Africa, just like they are doing to alleged victims of Holocaust?
Without doubt, you'd have seen in my previous answer, I've talked about slavery as if it were colonization, because in my view, slavery is really, colonization is slavery turned inside out. And in direct answer to your question, I'm saying that we deserve reparations. We don't ask for it. We don't act as a team as Africans. We are still victims of divide and rule. Your typical African leader, still, if they were colonized by the British or by the French or the Portuguese or the Germans or the Italians, still behave as if they are beholden to those countries. And that is why we can't speak with one voice.
Despite the so-called abolition of slavery in the United States, African Americans continue to suffer institutional racism, and the brutal murder of George Floyd is just an example of what people of African descent endure every day in America. Clearly, racism still lingers in the United States.
George Floyd is simply emblematic of what happens on a daily basis, and I think that it is incumbent upon us to keep speaking about and against it, because if we don't, it will continue to gain roots in subterranean and subtle ways.
The only known existing autobiography of an African slave in America was written in Arabic by Omar ibn Said. This autobiography debunked myths that enslaved Africans had no culture or civilization. How does the story of Omar ibn Said tell us about the distortion of the history of African Americans?
The history of Africa has always been distorted, and if you want to see the dramatization of this unfortunate situation, Alex Haley's Roots dramatizes the modus operandi of the slave master. First of all, they took away your language, they dehumanized you, they humiliated you, they erased your history, and they claimed that your life only started when you were enslaved. You did not know how to write, you did not think, you are simply one who had a human form, but you are not a human being, you are not a thinking being. And that continues to be perpetuated even today. And the time has come for Africans to begin to ask certain fundamental questions. Why is it that they destroyed the museums which were found in different parts of Africa? Why is it that they erased our history? And we too have an obligation to make it known to the world that we had a history.
Over the recent past, there have been reports of continued slavery in different parts of the world. Now, Mr. Lumumba, can you elaborate on this phenomenon?
You know, in my view, slavery has always metamorphosized. When the Western world recognized that slavery was no longer sustainable, it went into the next stage, which was colonization. And when colonization was no longer tenable and sustainable, it has transformed into the neocolonial project. And that is not to say that classical slavery has ended. We know that slavery is going on in different parts of the world. In the Sahelian region, slavery is alive and well. In different parts of Europe, slavery is still alive and well. But latter-day slavery is of an economic kind. We are so beholden to the erstwhile colonizer, the erstwhile slave master, and we do not know, and even if we do not know, we are not conscious of its very pervasive character. Today, the African economies are simply marionettes controlled from European capitals, which can be switched off without a notice.
Okay, Mr. Lumumba, our final question to you. What needs to be done to eliminate or eradicate these forms of economic slavery you just talked about?
African countries should work as a team, and there have been efforts in that direction, beginning with the Lagos Plan of Action of 1980. I now see the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. That is an initiative which should address the economic slavery and colonization that we still labor under. It is also important that Africans remove tariff and non-tariff barriers and allow their citizens to move across the continent without these impediments.
Thank you very much, Mr. PLO Lumumba, for your insight. Now, as our guest said, the African countries need to emancipate themselves from economic slavery that continues to be perpetrated by Western imperialist powers. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
rock quarry centrifuge. Science and technology, capital and industry, are both the basis for the growth and development of any country. 60 years have passed since the very first attempts were made to bring nuclear technology to Iran. Considering all the ups and downs in Western efforts to prevent Iran from achieving this science, with the efforts of the specialists and administrators in this field, we have reached such a level of growth and strength that's amazed the world and become the strength of the country's industry. In recent years, this progress has become so noteworthy because the scientific overflow of this technology has also been used for the development of other industrial sectors in the country. Our country, with regard to its vast underground oil and gas reserves, is one of the most important countries in the world. Iran's oil industry, that's almost 120 years old, is considered one of the oldest and most important pillars of global energy production and has a major share in the development of today's world. Since the most important infrastructures of a developed or developing country are related or dependent upon the oil industry, any improvement, progress, or change regarding self-sufficiency in the oil industry has a direct effect on the development of other sectors. The achievements in this field can be as vast as the country's industrial growth. In order to achieve this and reach new reservoirs, many sciences and techniques are used in well drilling to get to new hydrocarbon reservoirs. Among these sciences and accurate monitoring, which requires advanced technology, is the processing of rock samples soaked in petroleum, which are extracted from the Earth's different layers during the drilling process. These tests are of major importance for determining the characteristics of the reservoir.
In the name of God, hello. In the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, we have so far manufactured centrifuges for gas materials like UF6 gas, and for liquids we have designed and manufactured health centrifuges for the serum manufacturing industry and vaccines. But this was the first time we came across this machine. I mean the rock core centrifuge, a machine that is designed to centrifuge hard solids like rock that's been saturated in oil. Well, in the beginning, the overall structure of this device was similar to other centrifuges, but there are several major points about it. First of all, this machine was supposed to centrifuge a piece of solid rock, not liquid or gas, which is a very significant point.
The basis of the operation of the rock core machine is capillary action of solid. In nature, plants use this property to carry water and soil nutrients to their leaves through their stem. This property is one of the most important features of the rocks in hydrocarbon reservoirs. Each earth layer that leads to the hydrocarbon reservoir is made up of rocks or a specific type of soil. And how these fluids are distributed in porous layers of reservoir rocks are among the most important parameters required for research. Its analysis provides important information for the simulation of the existing hydrocarbon fluid flow in the various layers of the earth.
Centrifuging
hard solids like stone have major differences with liquids and gases. Liquids take the shape of the container and stabilize, but it's not so in the case of solids. Therefore, the balance system of this machine is of major importance because this machine operates in very high rounds. Another point is that the centrifugal process in this machine is done in two ways. First, the extraction of materials from the rock, and secondly, the entry of materials into it, which is known as inhibition. Therefore, there should be a design and plan for this.
For better checks and tests that are required, at first, the rock extracted from the depth of the ground is cut into the shape of a cylinder that can be placed in the bucket and then saturated with a fluid like water or oil. At this stage, the rock is placed in a bucket, and the remaining space in the bucket is filled with a fluid such as water or oil, or even air, and the buckets are then attached to the arm and placed in a big compartment called chamber. From this moment onwards, and as the machine starts operating, the centrifugal process begins. If the fluid extracted from the rock is heavier than the other fluid in the machine, this fluid is accumulated at the bottom of the bucket, which is known as draining. And if it's lighter, it accumulates on the upper part of the bucket and near the axis of rotation, which is called inhibition. In the first stage, the rotation speed is adjusted at a low level until the fluid outlet is stabilized. Then the speed increases, and at each speed increase stage, the outlet is recorded according to time, and the overall outlet is recorded. This is done with the help of a video processing system, which is analyzed using a software.
The older machines we checked out use a very simple control system. In order to improve the function of this machine, we had to design systems that used modern and updated technologies. Another major point was that old machines did not contain an imaging system and an image analyzing system. As our friends in the Petroleum Industry Research Institute had suggested, we became obliged to design and build a video imaging system for it, so it would be as up-to-date as the machines that currently exist in the world.
These types of centrifuges are made up of several parts. The main compartment is called a chamber, which contains the buckets and arms that move around during the centrifuge process. The buckets are attached to the arms, and each arm can have up to three buckets attached to it. The bucket is a compartment that holds the samples which have been extracted from the well for the tests. It's made up of a compartment that holds the rock and a grated compartment that holds the testing material. The engine and the rotational movement system of this engine can move the rotor and moving parts of this machine by up to 16,000 times per minute. Due to its very high speed, there has been much sensitivity in the design and construction of the electrical engine and vibration controlling system of the machine, which have been built in accordance with the dynamics and functional condition of this device. This system is responsible for using precision sensors which have been installed on the machine for this purpose and control the temperature, vacuum, vibrations, engine round per minute, and rotation time. This set also contains an image processing system which uses a camera, lens, computer, and image processing software to identify the boundary between water and oil and inform the operator.
This machine has been designed and manufactured by the experts at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, the Rock Core Centrifuge. The latest and most up-to-date world technologies have been used to design and manufacture this machine. I can tell you for sure that